Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to find out about chronic fatigue syndrome being linked to the bacteria in your gut. Cornell University has a good study on that, and I'll share that with you, along with about 14 other studies. Additionally, I had a person yesterday who asked me a question, and it was an interesting question. It dealt with Trump and his administration and how corrupt it was and how he had allowed the deep state to, in effect, take over his administration because of all of his appointments and his pro-hawkish military and pro-Israel positions. And I was rushed. I was not able to answer the person's question. So I said I'd answer today. But unfortunately, and this is the bad part, you would never know that any of the other administrations did the same thing, that this is an ongoing pattern where our government agencies have been fully captured by special interest groups. Now, they do it with, let's say, a different manner. They do it with a softer approach, not in your face. But it's nothing new. So today, a history lesson on civics, an in-depth history lesson that all governments are corrupt all the time, that every administration is corrupt, that not one administration represents the United States people, nor the people of the world. So hopefully we'll be able to understand what happens when we disconnect from larger lessons of history. Also today, we're going to get to what I didn't have a chance yesterday because of the length of the commentary, and that is looking at the arguments for New Green, which we all should be supporting. But based upon new information that we have uncovered, and we will be the first media outlet in the United States to share this with you, much of the New Green movement is controlled behind the scenes by major polluting corporations or people who benefit financially from controlling where the money goes in the green movement, the public-private partnerships. It didn't start now. It's been going on for a long time. But we're going to make it very clear. And we're going to use as an example nuclear and solar. So you're going to hear two arguments today, one that is pro-nuclear and one that is anti-nuclear. And the pro came at a TED conference, and it's a very well-thought-out argument, except that it's half right, which means it's half wrong. There's an old Jewish saying that a half-truth is a full lie. We'll explore that. So we begin with the latest on health and healing. And in that context, we have a lot of Americans suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome. Chronic fatigue syndrome, according to Cornell University, has mystified healthcare workers for a long time. In fact, there was a time when doctors in the United States didn't even believe it was real. They thought it was all psychosomatic. And they had all the psychological and psychiatric proof that it was all in your mind. Just like Balfour syndrome wasn't real, according to 30 years of denial that it was real. But it is real. It's absolutely 100% real. And it's a condition marked by simply a debilitating fatigue after just normal amounts of exertion. And this fatigue also isn't alleviated by getting a lot of rest. You get a lot of rest, you're still tired. And the diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome requires a lot of testing, because is it infections? Is it viral? Is it parasitic? Is it digestive? Is it heavy metal toxicity? Indeed, it could be all those. But the cause of chronic fatigue syndrome is really just one thing, and most always needs to be addressed on an individual basis. However, new evidence is indicating that chronic fatigue syndrome may be strongly linked to poor gut health, in particular the overall environment of the gut microbiome. Why? What are the details here? The Cornell researchers have identified some key biological markers related to chronic fatigue syndrome in gut bacteria, as well as inflammatory microbial agents in the bloodstream. A new study published in the peer-reviewed journal Microbiome detailed how the research team was able to correctly diagnose chronic fatigue syndrome through blood work and stool samples with a high degree of accuracy. And they said that chronic fatigue syndrome is not just psychological in nature, as many have believed. It actually has microbes affecting your DNA and the bacteria in your gut. And leaky gut syndrome could in part explain gastrointestinal symptoms and heightened immune response. There are also fewer anti-inflammatory bacteria species present in chronic fatigue syndrome. And researchers detect inflammation in the blood that was linked with leaky gut. What does it mean? Well, let's just say that you sit down to a meal. I'm going to make it very basic now. And let's say that it's the average meal today, meaning there's too many calories, too many fats, especially if you're on a paleo-keto diet. And these paleo and keto diets are just a disaster for your health, completely unscientific, but making them a lot of money for some people. And just like the high-protein diet has, it's a disaster for your health. Now, the body can only absorb so much protein. And therefore, after about 30 grams, it can't store it, so it breaks it down. This is called deaminization. In the process of breaking down the amino acids, you create two byproducts, urea and ammonia, both of which are very inflammatory. They're toxic. And the body has to get rid of this, and it gets rid of it through the kidneys and the liver. And that's one of the reasons that with high-protein diets and animal proteins, we're overtaxing our kidneys. But then it's not just excess protein that we're consuming. We generally consume, and it's all in the math. It's very simple. Let's just take an example. And I actually did this in the laboratory for a group of students. These were dietitians at Trafalgar Hospital. They were in their internship where they had to take so many hours. I think at that time it was 1,200 hours. And they had to learn. So I said, let's say that you're told by the doctor. Remember, the doctor is the only one who tells that a patient should get a particular diet. It's the dietitian who then has to find the different components to bring together to make sure they get the amount of protein, fat, carbohydrates, vitamins, mineral, and water that the patient requires. But therein is the problem. They don't distinguish the sugar in a teaspoon of white sucrose from the sugar in an apple. They think it's all the same. It is not, because all they're doing is counting calories from a sweetener instead of the fact that an apple has enzymes and fibers and it will be absorbed slower. It has a lower glycemic index, which means the body doesn't suddenly jump up in its blood sugar after you have something sweet. That's why when you eat beans, your blood sugar stays rather normal. But when you have white rice, boom, white bread, boom, white pasta, boom, sugar, candy, it pops up, and that's dangerous. In any case, meat is supposed to be good for diabetics because it stabilizes your blood sugar. It takes longer to digest. It doesn't have sugars in it, and that's correct. But let's just say that you're going to have meat in a restaurant today. And the thing with a lot of restaurants today is the more you give a customer, the more likely they are to come back. Because we've gotten as a nation to the idea of more is always better in everything. And so you want to go to the restaurant that doesn't give you little pieces of food, let's say little gourmet dishes. You want the big dishes. And you see it advertised on television. We got the meats. And you see this huge, burger, far more than what the body can handle. Now, this is where you start to kill yourself. Your liver, your kidneys, and inflammation, and gut bacteria. We're coming back to the gut bacteria. Because the bacteria that your body's going to manufacture from meat or animal product consumption is very toxic. It is not a positive, healthy, good microbiome. It is a toxic, poisonous microbiome. And it's congesting because meat has no fiber. So as meat is going down through the more than 22 feet of digestion that's required, it slows everything down because there's fat in meat, and fat has a different set of principles to which it has to adhere to be properly digested, including bile from the gallbladder. And there's a signal. Now, this is the miracle of the body. And that's why for those who have a little science, it takes them away from believing in higher intelligence. For those who have a lot of science, it frequently brings them back. That was a notion from Einstein. But I've seen that also, being a scientist my entire adult life and working with scientists in the laboratory and doing over 154 original studies, I can tell you that what came out at the end of that study was not just pure reductionistic mathematical science. It wasn't linear. It frequently is quantum. So here's where the quantum comes in. You put a piece of food in your mouth, immediately the body starts to digest it, not just by chewing and the mastication and the envelopment of mucus. And in that mucus comes tylen and amylase to start breaking down the complex starches, the polysaccharides, simpler monosaccharides. But already the body has been signaled that you have fat coming. So then you start the secretion of bile in through the bile duct, and ultimately it will help break down the fat into smaller and smaller particulate matter, which can be digested. Because if a piece of material is too large to go through the tiny little vessels that come down, the villi, then that food will pass right through your body. So you can be overfed and undernourished. The calories will be absorbed, but frequently the nutrients won't, because the nutrients were locked into food that you didn't chew properly, or you drank liquids and diluted your hydrochloric acid, and so the body was overfilling the stomach, and the stomach, in order to respond, started to dump. So it opened up a flap. The top flap is the cardiosphincter, and the bottom flap is pyloric sphincter, and the pyloric sphincter opens and partially digested with large chunks of food goes right into the intestine. The trouble is the intestine doesn't have teeth. It can't masticate. The stomach doesn't have teeth, so it has to use hydrochloric acid and pepsin, pepsingen, and amylase, and bromelase and other types, lipase of other types of enzymes to break down the nutrients. So it's all about the chemistry of breaking down the food. Now, if we were to show people a film of what happens when they eat that hamburger or pizza or drink a cola or a glass of alcohol, do you remember there was a photographs that circulated of Mao Zedong, and he caused the death of millions, over 40 million citizens. But during the fights with the Chinese, they would take anyone who opposed and they would hold two hands out at each side, and a person would be behind him and shoot him in the head. And they killed millions this way. And just imagine a film that showed 1 million brain cells being shot, and the alcohol is the bullet. Now, that kind of dramatic and graphic image would offend people, but at least it would hopefully scare them straight. Wow, there's a consequence to making wrong choices. Of course, the snowflakes don't realize it, because there's never a consequence to their stupidity and their narcissism and their selfish and self-righteous nature. But for the rest of the people who actually have lived through life and realize that it's a rough road that we all travel, it's just some people have the spiritual quality of a Krishnamurti and will pick the stone up that they see so it will not hit a foot they will never see. That's thoughtfulness towards others, something is grossly lacking in this generation, with some exceptions, of course. But then, when do we show that same grace to our body, to our liver, to our kidneys? 76 million Americans are obese. Whoa. There was a time in American culture when I was growing up and you were growing up where obesity was a rare occurrence. And we thought that it had to do with, you know, a defective thyroid, for example. That was the only cause. Because people just wouldn't eat themselves to death. There was no, why would you do that? And today, obesity is normal. And being overweight, remember, before you become obese or morbidly obese, you have to be overweight. And then there's a spectrum of overweight. I'm a little overweight, I'm a lot overweight, and I'm very overweight. Now I'm obese. I'm a little obese, I'm a lot obese, I'm very obese, I'm morbidly obese. And then you're dead. And so this is all in a cycle, and we're participating in this cycle. So if you saw everything that happened good, constructive, and bad, would it change what you do? In some people, it wouldn't matter. In other people, it would. Most people are reasonable and would say, hold on, I didn't know I was killing myself by eating that way, but I guess I was and I will change. Good. So let's say they say, okay, I've been eating in this restaurant and they give me a 16-ounce steak, and 16 ounces is a pound. So half that is going to be, for argument, let's say it's a prime cut, even filet mignon, 50% is fat. Okay, well, if 50% is fat, that's 8 ounces. So if you got 8 ounces at 28.35 grams to an ounce, you're at 224 grams of protein. That's a lot. That's a lot. So that's loading the body up with almost, well, just do the math. It's very simple. Let's just say we have 8 ounces of protein and we're doing 4 grams of protein, and that is going to give us 4 times daily requirement of protein in one meal, in one item in one meal. So all day long, anything else you eat for protein, you're creating a toxic reaction on your body. And one of those is chronic fatigue, because you're now going to be fatigued in your brain. You're taking in over 1,500 calories in one meal with one item. That doesn't count all the other snacks and all the other foods you're consuming that day. Now we wonder why we were obese, morbidly obese, and overweight. We think being overweight is normal. It's not. It kills you, creates inflammation, overstresses the heart. But it's also loading the body up with toxic bacteria. That toxic bacteria then leads to chronic inflammation, including inflammation of your entire body and your brain. And it starts in the gut. Good food in, good bacteria, good feelings, good health and immune system, bad bacteria, chronic fatigue. Baylor College of Medicine has an article published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition talking about, once again, the quality influence on microbiome composition in human colonic mucosa. And if you looked in the intestine, the healthier your food, high plant-based diet, lots of fibers, lots of fruits and vegetables and grains and nuts and seeds, the entire intestine, the entire colony is healthy. Separate article. It's getting a lot of attention. And University of Utah just had an article about the neurological damage from viral infections unless you have good microbes, in which case it protects your brain from viral infections. That's right. Disruptions in the gut microbiome caused by antibiotics, which destroy your good bacteria, and a bad diet is going to make your central nervous system more vulnerable to damage from viruses. So that's, you know, three studies in a row. Also, for those of you who, as I do, every day have 2 ounces of mulberry concentrate, good for you. Li Shen College published an article in the American Journal of Chinese Medicine showing that there's strong medicinal properties of the mulberry and can help you treat diabetes mellitus. So if you have diabetes, which a lot of people do, or prediabetes, then have yourself mulberry concentrate every day. From University of Alexandria, which is in Egypt, And that was once the capital. That's where Cleopatra held forth. Interesting, Cleopatra had her own brother, older brother and younger brother killed, then had her sister. Couldn't kill the sister. Caesar took Cleopatra's sister back to Rome. And the tradition in Rome, when you return from conquering a land, the very last thing and the very last person that in the procession is, which generally a wooden cage, and in that would be one of the leaders of the country, and then Caesar would then kill that person, generally strangling them to death. And in this case, it was I believe she was 17 at the time, this frail little lady, and the public became outraged, because here you can imagine this had never happened before, ever. And here was Julius Caesar and the Senate, and then the public was outraged when they saw that this was the Caesar was going to go up and strangle her. So they protested, they raised hell, and Caesar had to back off and instead sent her to an island where there was a monastery, and it was a sacred island. It had its own province and its laws, and once you were there, you were protected. You couldn't be killed there. And that's where she lived for the next about 16 years, more or less, 13 years maybe, until Mark Antony, who came after Caesar, and he then had an affair, a long affair with Cleopatra. I think it went on for around 13 years, and then decided to conquer Rome, which is a big mistake. But in the process, Cleopatra went to him and said, kill my sister. And he killed his sister, Cleopatra's sister. Most people are not aware of that. And by the way, everyone's always attributed Cleopatra being Greek. She wasn't Greek. The DNA show otherwise. In any case, University of Alexandria did a study on soybean isoflavones, and the soybean isoflavones ameliorates cognitive impairment and neuroinflammation and amyloid accumulation in Alzheimer's disease. So, if you have Alzheimer's, one of the best sources of quality protein you can take in is a fermented soy. You're getting good bacteria, the probiotics, and you're getting isoflavones. Now, this is a part of an overall expanded diet. It's just one small part. But if you have Alzheimer's or dementia, you want that because of its benefit. And finally, from Rush University Medical Center, a study shows that cinnamon is good for your brain. Yeah. Published in the Journal of Neuroimmunopharmacology. So when you're making your smoothie, protein shake in the morning, throw in a quarter of a teaspoon of cayenne cinnamon is probably your best, but almost any cinnamon will do. It's all good for you, and it's good for diabetics. And so I want to see people live longer and healthier lives. Well, by the way, University of Montreal, the more social media you attach to, the greater the rate of depression, especially if you're a teenager. That's why we have an awful lot. One of the reasons we have an awful lot of depressed teens. They're believing too much in social media instead of living in the real world. I'm Gary Null. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going into the pro side of the argument on nuclear. And I'm not going to play the whole thing because it would be too long, because I want to play the other part as well, the challenge. So you're going to hear two arguments. But this one was at a TED Talk, and it was from Michael Schellenberg, Schellenberg. And he believes that renewables like solar are not, and wind are not the answers. And by the way, some of his arguments are legitimate on these. But his arguments on nuclear are simply wrong, but we want you to hear what he has to say. in fairness to those who believe that nuclear is a safe and clean, non-polluting energy. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Without breaking down, haven't seen the sun since you've been gone. Like my heart I lost it when you left me, and it can't be found.
Of life, but my parents taught me to see the wildlife all around us. The hawks, the eagles, the tortoises. One time when we were setting up camp, we found a baby scorpion with its stinger out. And I remember thinking how cool it was that something could be both so cute and also so dangerous. After college, I moved to California and I started working on a number of environmental campaigns. I got involved in helping to save the state's last ancient redwood forest and blocking a proposed radioactive waste repository set for the desert. Shortly after I turned 30, I decided I wanted to dedicate a significant amount of my life to solving climate change. I was worried that global warming would end up destroying many of the natural environments that people had worked so hard to protect. I thought the technical solutions were pretty straightforward. Solar panels on every roof, electric car in the driveway, that the main obstacles were political. And so I helped to organize a coalition of the country's biggest labor unions and biggest environmental groups. Our proposal was for a $300 billion investment in renewables. And the idea was not only would we prevent climate change, but we would also create millions of new jobs in a very fast-growing high-tech sector. Our efforts really paid off in 2007, when then-presidential candidate Barack Obama embraced our vision. And between 2009 and 2015, the U.S. invested $150 billion in renewables and other kinds of clean tech. But right away, we started to encounter some problems. So first of all, the electricity from solar rooftops ends up costing about twice as much as the electricity from solar farms. And both solar farms and wind farms require covering a pretty significant amount of land with solar panels and wind turbines, and also building very big transmission lines to bring all that electricity from the countryside into the city. Both of those things were often very strongly resisted by local communities, as well as by conservation biologists who were concerned about the impacts on wild bird species and other animals. Now, there was a lot of other people working on technical solutions at the time. One of the big challenges, of course, is just the intermittency of solar and wind. They only generate electricity about 10 to 30% of the time during most of the year. But some of the solutions that were being proposed were to convert hydroelectric dams into gigantic batteries. The idea was that when the sun was shining and the wind was blowing, you would pump the water uphill, store it for later, and then when you needed electricity, run it over the turbines. In terms of wildlife, some of these problems just didn't seem like a significant concern. So when I learned that house cats kill billions of birds every year, it put into perspective the hundreds of thousands of birds, rather, that are killed by wind turbines. It basically seemed to me at the time that most, if not all, of the problems of scaling up solar and wind could be solved through more technological innovation. But as the years went by, these problems persisted and in many cases grew worse. So California is a state that's really committed to renewable energy, but we still haven't converted many of our hydroelectric dams into big batteries. Some of the problems are just geographic. It's just you have to have a very particular kind of formation to be able to do that. And even in those cases, it's quite expensive to make those conversions. Other challenges are just that there's other uses for water, like irrigation. And maybe this is the most significant problem, is just that in California, the water in our rivers and reservoirs is growing increasingly scarce and unreliable due to climate change. In terms of this issue of reliability, as a consequence of it, we've actually had to stop the electricity coming from the solar farms into the cities because there's just been too much of it at times. Or we've been starting to pay our neighboring states like Arizona to take that solar electricity. The alternative is to suffer from blowouts of the grid. And it turns out that when it comes to birds and cats, cats don't kill eagles. Eagles kill cats. What cats kill are the small, common, sparrows and jays and robins, birds that are not endangered and not at risk of going extinct. What do kill eagles and other big birds like this kite, as well as owls and condors and other threatened and endangered species, are wind turbines. In fact, they're one of the most significant threats to those big bird species that we have. We just haven't been introducing the airspace with many other objects like we have wind turbines over the last several years. And in terms of solar, you know, building a solar farm is a lot like building any other kind of farm. You have to clear the whole area of wildlife. So this is a picture of one-third of one of the biggest solar farms in California called Ivanpah. In order to build this, they had to clear the whole area of desert tortoises, literally pulling desert tortoises and their babies out of burrows, putting them on the back of pickup trucks and transporting them to captivity, where many of them ended up dying. And currently, the current estimates are that about 6,000 birds are killed every year, actually catching on fire above the solar farm and plunging to their deaths. Over time, it gradually struck me that there was really no amount of technological innovation that was going to make the sun shine more regularly or wind blow more reliably. In fact, you could make solar panels cheaper, you could make wind turbines bigger, but sunlight and wind are just really dilute fuels. And in order to produce significant amounts of electricity, you just have to cover a very large landmass with them. In other words, all of the major problems with renewables aren't technical. They're natural. Well, dealing with all of this unreliability and the big environmental impacts obviously comes at a pretty high economic cost. You know, we've been hearing a lot about how solar panels and wind turbines have come down in cost in recent years, but that cost has been significantly outweighed by just the challenges of integrating all of that unreliable power onto the grid. Just take, for instance, what's happened in California. At the period in which solar panels have come down in price very significantly, same with wind, we've seen our electricity prices go up 5 times more than the rest of the country. And it's not unique to us. You can see the same phenomenon happened in Germany, which is really the world's leader in solar, wind, and other renewable technologies. Their prices increased 50% during their big renewable energy push. Now, you might think, well, dealing with climate change is just going to require that we all pay more for energy. That's what I used to think. But consider the case of France. France actually gets twice as much of its electricity from clean zero-emission sources than does Germany. And yet, France pays almost half as much for its electricity. How can that be? Well, you might have already anticipated the answer. France gets most of its electricity from nuclear power, about 75% in total. And nuclear just ends up being a lot more reliable, generating power 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for about 90% of the year. We see this phenomenon show up at a global level. So, for example, there's been a natural experiment over the last 40 years, even more than that, in terms of the deployment of nuclear and the deployment of solar. You can see that at a little bit higher cost, we got about half as much electricity from solar and wind than we did from nuclear. Well, what does all this mean for going forward? I think one of the most significant findings to date is this one. Had Germany spent $580 billion on nuclear instead of renewables, it would already be getting 100% of its electricity from clean energy sources and all of its transportation energy. Now, I think you might be wondering, and it's quite reasonable to ask, is nuclear power safe? And what do you do with the waste? Well, those are very reasonable questions. Turns out that there's been scientific studies on this going over 40 years. This is just the most recent study that was done by the prestigious British medical journal Lancet, finds that nuclear power is the safest. It's easy to understand why. According to the World Health Organization, about 7 million people die annually from air pollution, and nuclear plants don't emit that. As a result, the climate scientist James Hansen looked at it, and he calculated that nuclear power has already saved almost 2 million lives to date. It turns out that even wind energy is more deadly than nuclear. This is a photograph taken of two maintenance workers in the Netherlands shortly before one of them fell to his death to avoid the fire, and the other one was engulfed in flames. Now, what about environmental impact? Well, I think a really easy way to think about it is that uranium fuel, which is what we use to power nuclear plants, is just really energy dense. About the same amount of uranium as this Rubik's Cube can power all of the energy that you need in your entire life. as a consequence, you just don't need that much land in order to produce a significant amount of electricity. Here we can compare the solar farm I just described, Ivanpah, to California's last nuclear plant, Diablo Canyon. It takes 450 times more land to generate the same amount of electricity as it does from nuclear. You would need 17 more solar farms like Ivanpah in order to generate the same output as Diablo Canyon, and of course it would then be unreliable. Well, what about the mining and the waste and the material throughput? Well, this has been studied pretty closely as well, and it just turns out that solar panels require 17 times more materials than nuclear plants do, in the form of cement, glass, concrete, steel, and that includes all the fuel used for those nuclear plants. The consequence is that what comes out at the end, since it's material throughput, is just not a lot of waste from nuclear. All of the waste from the Swiss nuclear program fits into this room. Nuclear waste is actually the only waste from electricity production that's safely contained and internalized. Every other way of making electricity emits the waste into the natural environment, either as pollution or as material waste. We tend to think of solar panels as clean, but the truth is that there is no plan to deal with solar panels at the end of their 20 or 25 year life. A lot of experts are actually very concerned that solar panels are just going to be shipped to poor countries in Africa or Asia with the rest of our electronic waste stream to be disassembled, often exposing people to really high levels of toxic elements, including lead, cadmium, and chromium, elements that, because they're elements, their toxicity never declines over time. I think we have an intuitive sense that nuclear is a really powerful, strong energy source, and that sunlight is really dilute and diffuse and weak, which is why you have to spread solar collectors or wind collectors over such a large amount of land. Maybe that's why nobody was surprised when, in the recent science fiction remake of Blade Runner, the film opens in a very dark dystopian scene where California's deserts have been entirely paved with solar farms. All of which I think raises a really uncomfortable question. In the effort to try to save the climate, are we destroying the environment? Well, the interesting thing is that over the last several hundred years...
So there you've heard the pro-nuclear argument. Before we go to the anti-nuclear argument for balance, since I've written many articles on nuclear and produced the multi-award-winning documentary Knocking on the Devil's Door and led demonstrations, the largest demonstration in New York's history, in front of the governor's office. There were thousands of people from this audience. Many of you might have been there, as well as up at Indian Point. Here are the arguments he chose. Maybe he doesn't know this. In point of fact, solar panels can be broken apart, and they can be biodegraded through different technologies we have today, and then they can be dealt with, not dumping them into a public pit. But spent fuel rods can never be safely put anywhere. There's nowhere in America that they want these spent fuel rods. And if an accident occurred at, let's say, the open-air spent fuel rods, that would create a Fukushima, but even worse. And that would be completely destroying a city forever. Also, with artificial intelligence, if someone were able to hack the system, they could bring down a nuclear power plant and cause a meltdown, as well as other forms of disaster as well. Also, it's very expensive. It is far more expensive than solar or wind. And he didn't mention that the new wind has no blades, therefore it doesn't have the noise, nor does it kill the birds, both of which are real and both of which were problems. And there's a whole new generation of solar. My whole home was the first one that I'm aware of in Florida to be completely 100% solar. This is 23 years ago I had that installed. It was more expensive than there were bigger panels, etc. But now everything is much cheaper. So he is correct on many of the limitations of wind and solar. He is absolutely right. And so therefore, I give them the benefit of a doubt because I believe he is one of these extremely well-intentioned and committed people who are looking for answers, but he's looking in the wrong place when it comes to nuclear. That said, in just a moment, we're going to go over to the other argument. And let me just mention before then, we have some, I'm coming back to the city, so there's a lot going on. For example, to help our sister station, WBAI, I'll be doing a premiere of Deadly Deception, powerful film. And if you'd like to join me for the film and a Q&A after, and a preview of the environmental film I've been working on for 8 years, and as Val, our editor, said this morning, she said, and she's worked with me, I guess, for 30-plus years, she said, this is quite simply the most all-inclusive environmental film ever produced. And when you see it, and you'll see a trailer, we're going to show you an extended trailer. For those of you who come, you'll see why it's important. I'll have that premiere in the fall. So if you want to join me, it's next Thursday. Call the station. All the proceeds go to the station. I'm even donating two films to every participant so you can take it home with you. Keep one for yourself, for your own archives, and share one so others can learn about this issue. Call 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. Now, that's on a Thursday of next week. Next Sunday, I'll be out at the Huntington Arts Cinema, and a different show altogether. Very powerful documentary. In fact, it's the most award-winning documentary we're aware of in the world this year. So I'll be there for that, and there'll be a lecture afterwards. So if you want to join me for that, we've made it real easy, because they haven't. I'm going to talk with the owner. Man, do you make it difficult. No phone number. So we put everything you need to know on my website. Just go to GaryNall.com, and there's a banner on the homepage, and you click to get tickets. So this connects them directly to the Cinema and Arts page to purchase tickets. So if you want to join me next Sunday out in Long Island, Huntington Arts Cinema, for a different film, then go to GaryNall.com. The Woodstock event, where this is Woodstock, remember, and everything in Woodstock happens in like one-tenth the time and quality of anywhere else in the world. What a place. And I'm not making that up. What a place. Anyhow, I'm happy to go up there. They play our radio show every day up in Woodstock. And the trouble is the people are so high they forget to listen. Was Gary on? Yeah, every day at noon. You're still sleeping, dude. Yeah, it's going to be the first week in August, and we'll have information on that as soon as they get it to us. And finally, we are full for my health support group, the four Sundays in August. However, we're full as far as people calling in and making reservations. But for the first one, at 1 o'clock each Sunday for four Sundays, for diabetes, arthritis, fatigue, and that means a full spectrum of fatigue from chronic fatigue syndrome and Lyme's disease, etc., and insomnia, we want you to provide us some verification and documentation you actually have these conditions. And a lot of people won't, and there'll be about 20% of people that never show up. That's the way it is. So you can still call and probably get in. You'll be on a waiting list, but we're going to tell the people by the end of next week, if you haven't sent in your paperwork, you're not, unfortunately, going to be a part of this. So if you want to get on the wait line, now's the time to do it. 646-926-5459. 646-926-5459. And I'll be teaching each of those myself. Now, the one that happens right after that at 3 o'clock to 4:30 deals with loneliness, depression, sadness, loss of purpose and meaning, challenges of getting through mourning, and a sense of disconnect because of crisis or traumas you've gone through. That's a separate workshop altogether. That you do not have to have any medical documentation for. Call the same number. Now we're going to go to the work to the group of people recently that Professor Carl Grossman, one of the most knowledgeable people in the world about the dangers of nuclear. And one of the people that you're going to meet is the former head of the Nuclear Regulatory Agency. He's a scientist, and he's got some very salient points. Now to that clip.
Dr. Gregory Jasko, former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. He has a Ph.D. in atomic physics, knows all about nuclear power, and he was thrown out of the chairmanship of the NRC because after the Fukushima nuclear plant disaster, he said we must consider lessons learned from Fukushima in any nuclear power proceeding.
I spent a number of years as the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and during that time, I dealt with a very significant accident, the Fukushima accident in Japan. In the morning, when I first learned about the situation in Japan, it was Friday, March 11th, 2011, and I was alerted to a major earthquake and a large tsunami that had occurred, off the coast of Japan, which initially was something that we were worried about because that tsunami wave had the potential to travel all the way across the ocean and affect plants on the west coast of the United States. Thankfully, that didn't become an issue. The tsunami wave was not large by the time it got there. But you think about the magnitude of that incident, that it was potentially causing a wave to go all the way across the ocean. Well, much closer to where that happened were a number of nuclear power plants on the coast of Japan. And over the course of really the next 4 or 5 months of my life, I spent almost every day dealing with the aftermath of that earthquake and that tsunami. And that was nothing compared to the consequences for the people who lived in and around that community, and really for the entire country of Japan. Over 100,000 people were evacuated from their homes because of that accident. Many of them will never be able to go back to their homes, their community, their families, their livelihoods, the life that they knew. And when you hear a statement like that, and certainly when I hear statements like that, what I think about is there must have been a terrible, terrible tragedy, a war, a civil war, some type of conflict. But when you think about it, it was a nuclear power plant or a number of nuclear power plants that are there to generate electricity. Something is fundamentally wrong when we're dealing with a technology that is producing those kinds of consequences, and somehow we have not yet figured out that this is not the right way forward. When that accident happened in 2011, we were really on the cusp, I think, of really people everywhere recognizing that there were alternatives. Because, of course, the bigger threat, really, and I think we could all acknowledge that the biggest threat that we face right now from an environmental perspective is climate change. Well, when I was chairman, at the same time that I was dealing with the nuclear incident in Japan, I was also dealing with a massive push by the industry to regulate or to license the first new nuclear power plants in this country in decades. Four nuclear power plants, in fact, in the southern United States were licensed. I did not support those, largely because I didn't feel that as an agency we were doing enough to make those plants up to the most modern standards to deal with a Fukushima-type accident. So I didn't. In hindsight, that's looking like a better and better decision. But today, if you look at what's going on with those reactors, two of those projects have been canceled. Two of them continue at the tune of $28 billion. So on the one hand, this is a technology that has this ability for catastrophic accidents. It's also a technology that has been unable over its entire existence to be able to be executed in a meaningful, cost-conscious, responsible way. When you put those two factors together, they do not add up to a solution for climate change. In fact, what they add up to is, as you've heard, is a detriment to climate change. So what I see right now, and it's very interesting because I've lived through these incidents. I lived through the licensing of the plants in Georgia and South Carolina and the promises at the time from the industry that these plants would be built on time and on budget. Because as I talked to the people on Wall Street who were financing or backing those projects, they assured me that if those plants were not built on time and on budget, there would be no more interest in nuclear power in this country. And of course, that's exactly what's happened. The industry has moved to the States. And what they're trying to do now is preserve these plants that are really no longer able to compete economically and are really losing out to better, cleaner technologies. So You know, when I think of a solution for climate change, the thing that does not come to mind is nuclear power. And in fact, the solutions are out there. In California alone, in the last 5 years, they added about 11 gigawatts of new solar, which is about 11 nuclear power plants in that time frame. While in South Carolina and Georgia, they struggled to build four to the tune of $28 billion. So I think the answer is quite clear that the future for electricity is now easy. We no longer have to make a very difficult choice between the scourge of climate change and the potential radiation impacts from nuclear power or accident impacts from nuclear power. That solution is now clear. The economics are in favor of alternative energy sources, and the administrative, the ability to execute is on the side of those technologies. So, you know, as I look to the future, I think the future is very bright. What we have to continue to do is to educate elected officials that we no longer need nuclear power plants, that we can survive without them, and we can meet the climate objectives that we have. And so I'm really glad to be a part of this, for people to talk about that message and to get that message out so we continue, or we stop putting caps.
So there is just, and it was a panel of six specialists. I have the clip on PRN.fm. You can watch the entire argument, but you have two different arguments, one pro, one against. And I do not see wind and solar as being the future. I believe that they will play a role, but they are both polluting in their current technologies. I see wave power, and I see geothermal. We have hundreds of geothermal springs, large ones, around the United States, and they could be tapped, much like Iceland and other countries, Nordic countries, have used geothermal. We haven't used them at all. So those are two that we could use that could make a huge difference. And also we could do things like Joe from our audience was listening and just wrote me, "Hi, Gary, I'm listening to the show right now talking about power. This is one solution. Every mile or so along the Hudson River, get a water turbine that makes electricity." Okay, Joe. That's possible, providing that you have the flow of water, because you have to have a certain velocity of water going across a turbine for the blades to turn, for the blades then to create the energy, the electrical energy. And that's why your largest electro power was, for example, up near Niagara Falls, using the falls and other high water velocity in different parts of the country. But it's certainly an idea. But the biggest impediment we have to global warming is very simply this. We need to switch from a meat-based to a plant-based diet. That would help us with our health, it would lower our carbon footprint, and it would also help rejuvenate local, organic, sustainable agriculture. It would stop the pollution into our rivers and streams and estuaries of hog waste and cow waste and chicken waste. It would stop the abuse of the animals. And it would then be economically sensible, because the majority of the fish in the world are not eaten by humans. They're fed to cattle, which is insane. So that protects the fish, which are being fished out in the world. It protects the soil. It gets away from industrial agriculture. Secondly, we should be planting trees. Now, there are different types of trees we could plant, and there's different types of carbon sinks. Not everything is a carbon sink, but hemp is a very good one, and hemp grows four times faster than a regular tree, can be used to make clothes, can be used to make paper, so we don't have to fell trees. We can harvest hemp that can be replanted quickly and get back to where it can be recycled very promptly, versus a tree might take 80 years before it gets back to its normal position. Thirdly, with about 100 billion trees planted in the United States, we should also be planting other greens like hedges, hedgerows across America that could employ local people, and it would also help green America. And then try to have an educational program at the most sustainable places to live. Because right now, if you live in New Orleans, Louisiana, and Mississippi, and in the Delta area in particular, you have no future. What they just experienced was only a Category 1, so the wind wasn't bad, but the water was water bombs. Last year it was Houston, where they received 19 trillion gallons of water in 5 days, so much water that it was 5 feet standing water because there was no absorbability of the rest of the water underground. That meant that all the chemicals were in the water now are in the ground, and they're aerosolized, which means that the moment you walk on ground that's been dried, it's dust, and when the dust goes in the air, you're breathing in all those petrochemicals. Very toxic for our health. And then just stop buying stuff we don't need. If we stopped overconsumption, that would make a difference. But our entire current financial market is keep growing, and we shouldn't. We should start shrinking our economic footprint, but making what we do buy go back to the old-fashioned, buy it as if you're going to use it and keep it for a long time, instead of everything now has built-in obsolescence. You can buy a dress for $10. You don't like it, throw it away. Wear it, soil it, throw it away, and then buy another one, instead of buying something that you're going to keep. So we should have a whole re-education upon the significance of having the things in life that we need versus the things we thought we wanted because we were conditioned by the market and advertising and propagandizing to feel that we need something that we actually don't. Shift over to organic from GMOs and a diversified diet, plant-based diet rather than a meat-based diet, and we will have made an enormous, immediate impact upon global change in the tipping points. And those tipping points are tipping. And right now, all the Arctic Circle, and that's a big area. You're talking about going over through Siberia and the boreal forest. That's all melting. The permafrost is melting. And there's going to be what we call methane burps, where you suddenly see a crater 100 feet across and maybe 50-100 feet deep, and that's methane that's released. And hundreds of thousands of those are going to be released. And when that happens, global warming will no longer in our lifetime be able to be stopped, and it'll accelerate to such a level that within 5 years from now, you're going to have a rough time growing a lot of our products unless they're under controlled conditions in the plain states, in the breadbasket, and in Canada. Canada's going to be hit really hard because the radical change in the climate, the seed chemistry will not stay up with it. Trees will simply go barren and die. So these are some suggestions. Hope you're all having a good day, and thank you for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
Hey, hey! Oh, yeah, baby. Like a fool, I went and stayed too long.